You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Nick Mason's Chicago is everything a gritty crime fiction writer would imagine, with a heavy dose of reality thrown in. It's a world created by award-winning and best-selling author Steve Hamilton. The second of his series of books about Nick Mason just came out this week. It's called Exit Strategy. Hamilton, a Michigan native, joins me now here in downtown Chicago. Hey, Steve, welcome to the 21st.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
So you are a prolific writer. Is this your 12th? The beginning of the series was your 12th
book? Yeah, this is 13, I
think. This is 13. Now, your first series set in Michigan, right, where you're from originally. Why did you choose Chicago for the Nick Mason series?
When I was thinking up this character, one of the first things that you decide is where he's from, because where you come from is such a big part of who you are. And there's something about Chicago, and specifically the South Side, that just felt like this is where this guy has to come from. And I felt like growing up right around the lake that I knew the city just well enough to write about it. Although when I came here to really live here for a while and to really get to know it, I think I really discovered that this amazing city is unlike anything I ever expected.
Yeah, I think so. And we can talk about that in a minute. But I want to talk about Nick Mason for a little bit, your character. So in my head, I kind of decided he was like Vin Diesel, you know, because I was trying to think of a guy who's really big, but still has kind of a face that children love, like that children are not scared of. And
right.
I wonder sort of in your head, I don't think
he's that big, really.
OK. I
mean, he's just a tough guy. I mean, he grew up in on the South Side, and he became a criminal, and he was stealing cars, and all the while he kept some very strict codes for himself and some very strict rules to sort of keep himself alive and stay out of prison. He was a very good criminal.
And those rules we learn about in the first book, and it was fascinating to me, sort of, he's in prison. So
right.
When we first meet Nick, he's actually just leaving prison.
Right, he's walking out.
Right? But he has this code that he creates, these rules for himself to survive being in prison.
Right.
I imagine that's probably, did you talk to people? It seems like something that would make sense for someone to try to figure out, this is how I'm going to survive being
right.
incarcerated.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent time in maximum security prisons, which is, again, part of being a crime writer is that research and going to the places where your characters are going to be. And it was an amazing experience, by the way. If you ever have a chance to go to a maximum security prison, I hope it's not for long, but if you ever go there and just visit for an hour, even though you know you're getting out in an hour, there's something that happens when that door closes. It's just like this physical reaction to it. And that was the feeling that I used as a writer when I was trying to imagine what Nick Mason would have felt like if he went to this place and the door closed, and he knew he was probably never going to come out. And that mindset is what, you know, is sort of where you first see him when he's taken this deal from Darius Cole that gets him out because he has to go back and see his family again. And so that's, you know, even though he is a criminal, I hope you can relate to that motivation that he has just to see his daughter again.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that ambiguity, right? Because he's a character who kills people for a living, and as we sort of see his transition into the second, you kind of start to see how he actually gets really good at killing people, right? But he's also, before we get to that, a character that I think is a very likable character, and I think that you are cheering for him, right? You kind of you feel like he's in a really tough situation, and at least for me, I was feeling like, okay, I'm on this guy's side.
That's the challenge of writing a character like this, and that's been the most amazing thing about the response to the series, because you know, as a writer, you're never sure that you can pull that off.
But that was your intention with
that. That was my intention. That was my hope. But it's people have really responded to this character, and I think it's that side of him that they get to see, especially like in the first book when he finally sees his daughter again after all this time going through all these brutal things. You understand that he's doing all this just to have that moment where he can tell his daughter, who he hasn't seen in 5 years, that he just made a mistake and he just wants to be her father.
But when you thought about that, and then you sort of think about his boss, who is a much more unambiguous character. When you kind of, I wonder if I could get inside your head a little bit as you're developing these characters, do you decide from the beginning that this is going to be, that we're not, or we haven't, we've yet to see with his boss, this kind of crime lord, Darius Cole, we don't really see a good side to him.
You really don't, but in the second book, at least you start to understand him and where he came from. Hemingway once said that a writer should understand his characters but not judge them. And that's really what I try to do. It's just I just want you to understand, especially for somebody like Darius Cole, who obviously doesn't have anything on paper that you could root for, at least just understand where he came from and what choices he had growing up, and what drives him, and how that's really not that much different maybe than you and I. He just obviously has a whole different way of going about it. But I just try to understand him, and then you as a reader can judge what kind of person he ultimately is.
Right, and so then the other kind of character in this is Chicago, right? Because
right. Yeah.
This is such a, Chicago is such a city of neighborhoods.
It is.
And you do are very specific about where Nick comes from, where Darius comes from. Yeah. How did you pick those neighborhoods?
Just spending time here, really. When I decided this is where he's from, I just came here and I got to know a lot of the people who live here and spent time with the police officers. I have a good friend who's a homicide detective, which these days is a pretty tough job. For this second book especially, I got to know an assistant U.S. attorney who works in that office and really learn about that job. I didn't realize just how important these guys are to every federal case. It has to basically start with the U.S. Attorney's Office. You can't even charge somebody without calling them and asking permission. It's all part of the process of living in this world. And that was the nicest thing about it, was just getting to know Chicago a lot better. It's a beautiful, amazing city.
What kind of research? So how much time did you spend with people like your friend, you said, who's a homicide right. detective, the assistant U.S. attorney? How much research do you put into before you start writing?
It's been 2 or 3 years now of just not all the time, but coming back here a lot and just hanging out and driving around. I'll just go into a bar sometimes, and you can tell who wants to talk in a bar, you know. And I'll just start talking about somebody.
Do you tell them what you do, or you just start talking?
No,
okay,
don't.
You don't.
No, I don't. Eventually, maybe it'll come out.
All right.
But I love that kind of research where you just go into a bar, the local bar. You can tell these people have lived there.
It's their bar.
It's their bar. And
yeah.
And I'm very conscious of that, and I don't try to be the big shot. You know, I think that would ruin it if I tried, hey, I'm a big shot New York Times
bestseller. You don't say, I've won an Edgar Award.
No. I just hang out, and I just, hey, what's it like living here, you know? Well, you know, I bet you've been here your whole life, and people like to talk about things that they care about, which is why cops like to talk about their job, and somebody who lives in a neighborhood likes to talk about what it is that makes that to them makes this place special, and that's all I do. I'm a very good listener.
And so it's interesting because all of that listening does lead to Chicago. The way that Chicago is depicted, and I do think, and I think you know this as well, you, like myself, both people who are not from Chicago, I think the first thing you learn when you come to Chicago, if you're not from Chicago, is to never say that you're from this town, right? Because people are so proud of being from Chicago. It's kind of a joke how fast they say, I'm from Chicago. And so you can always say, well, this isn't where I'm from. You could live here for 30 years and say, I know I'm really not from here. I've just lived here for 30 years. Were you intimidated by that, by picking Chicago?
I was aware of it, I would say. I wasn't really intimidated by it because I think I've done that before in other places. I think if you're just true to the place and you're just really honest and you respect the place, I think people see that. I think it comes through in the writing, too. I think it comes through that I really do love this place and that I'm not trying to make fun of it or just take an easy pot shot at the crime problems or any of the more obvious things that are in the papers. I just try to understand it.
Right. And I should point out, as Chicago Tribune actually pointed out for in the review of your first book, that you were an outsider who did a pretty good job capturing.
That felt really good. That,
yeah.
That was a front page review in the... In that section of the paper, and it was a great review of the first book, And when I read that part about how it's not often that an outsider gets Chicago right, then that was like the best thing that I ever could have read.
I'm speaking with Steve Hamilton. We're talking about his latest Nick Mason novel. It's called Exit Strategy. It just came out this week. And in the second book, you know, we talked about Nick. He's really trying to find his way out of this life, right? And there's, I'm not going to give anything away. There's some great twists and turns that happen here. But in your head, where is Nick at the beginning of this book? Where, what do you think his mindset is?
Well, at the beginning of this book, sort of at the end of the first book, he's, you know, the first book was all about him getting out of prison and discovering what the price was that he'd have to pay to, you know, when he made this deal. And if you think about it, I mean, every time that phone rings, it's just, and that's a terrible sort of vice grip that you have to live in, always being watched, knowing that everybody that you come in contact with, you could be putting them in danger.
Right. So the guy who gets him out of prison, he's now beholden to.
Exactly. Exactly. So as this book begins, like you said, it begins with a bang. He's on his next mission, and these missions are just getting more and more dangerous and brutal. And he's finding it harder and harder to hold on to that one thing that he, that one piece of his code, which is to not kill anybody that's not a target. He's going to such lengths, and it's getting harder and harder. And he just inside, he can feel himself turning into this machine, and he's losing his humanity. And he decides, I have to get out of this, no matter what I have to do.
There are there's like sort of this melding, and I wonder. As you do, you were saying you talk to, well, you have a good friend who's a homicide detective. One thing that I thought, I was thinking a lot about when I was reading this is there are a lot of good, there's a lot of good police officers, there's a lot of bad police officers in here. And I wonder if you thought about, if you, especially now, kind of as we're in sort of this national moment of having a conversation about policing, is that something you thought about when you were writing this?
Well, I was just going back. You know, it is something that we're all very aware of here. But Chicago has its own history, good and bad. There really was a crew of cops called the SOS that operated in the city a number of years ago, long before any of these other things started happening. And they did kind of rule this town for a few years. And they had, and there was a very high profile case.
Yeah, I have to say, kind of, I was wincing every time you said Holman Square in the book because I kept thinking about John Burge.
Right.
And for those who are not aware, sort of the infamous torture of multiple people that went on under his command. The only reparations lawsuit that's ever existed, that's ever happened in the country here in Chicago, just settled 2 years ago, I think it was at this point, right? And so every time you mention Holman Square in the book, I kind of winced inside.
I know what you mean, but it's funny, when I was writing that first book, that was before all that stuff even
had come out. Before it had all come out.
But that's where the SOS crew was located. So that's really, that was the only way that I had, the only connection that I had to that place. And it was, I was just really sort of blown away when that stuff did come out. It's like, it was almost like it was worse than I could have imagined as a crime writer.
It was the reality
right.
of it. But then on the other hand, so there's those really tough ones. And then there's also an incident you have, which I have to say, it just sort of started laughing when I was reading it, because it, this is also true. In 2012, the guys who escaped from the downtown Metropolitan
right.
Correction Center. Literally, I will never forget the TV footage of, they had the sheets.
Just
they had sheets, and they just threw them over and they went out.
Just like in an old movie, they actually did that. You're right.
So when you, how much real life stuff does kind of ends up in here? Are you someone who reads the crime section, or are you always kind of following that news?
I really am, especially now in this town. Now that I have a series based here, I'm all the stuff every day. I have a feed that comes in, and I see all the stuff that's going on here.
And that said, then I guess I wonder how much then you do that is. Where do you sort of draw the line between thinking about what ends up in this series and in Nick Mason's world versus real life?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be respectful of the fact that, I mean, this is a real place and these are real problems and people are definitely impacted by them. I do have a cop in this book who goes to Holman Square and sort of reflects on the fact that that it's getting hard for him to do his job. And this goes back to the idea, I mean, you've got a few bad cops, every city does, and they reflect badly on everybody else. But a friend like my friend John, who just gets up and wants to just do a good job for this city every day, sometimes they're the ones who pay for it because it makes their job a lot harder. And I just try to be, I don't try to get too hung up on that or really dwell on it too much, because it really shouldn't be about that.
Steve's going to be back in town in June for Printers Row Lit Fest, so you can catch him then next month, June 10th or 11th. Right now, I want to thank him. So the latest book, it's called Exit Strategy. Great summer reading. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for being with
me. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Stay tuned. This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In the spring of 1944, a young girl, Eva Moses Kaur, was taken away from her family along with her twin sister. And in the months that followed, they, along with 1,500 other sets of twins, were placed on near-starvation diets, subjected to horrific human experimentation under the guidance of Nazi Dr. Joseph Mengele, who you may have heard of known as the Angel of Death. The experimentation lasted for 9 months, and of the 3,000 people who were in that concentration camp in Auschwitz, only an estimated 200 survived, but Eva Moses Kaur was one of them. She now lives in Terre Haute, Indiana. She's the founding director of the Candles Holocaust Museum, and she's on the line with us there from now, from Terre Haute. Eva, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for taking the time to share your story with us today.
Thank you very much, Nyla. I am very glad to be with you.
Eva, you were just 10 years old when you and your family, you had three siblings and your parents. You were ordered to board. We've heard the story of how people were forced into cattle cars. You were in that car for 4 days before you were met with Nazi soldiers. What do you remember from that day when you arrived at the camp?
It was early morning. We couldn't even see very well as the cattle car doors opened after 4 days. We were immediately rushed out, schnell, schnell, fast, fast. And we, as we detrained or somehow got off the cattle car, which I don't exactly remember how it happened. One moment I was up, next moment I was on that cement platform. My mother was holding on to me and my twin sister Miriam. And I was very curious at age 10. And I just looked around to try to figure out what on earth is this place. And as I looked around, I realized that my father and my two older sisters disappeared in the crowd. And, of course, I never saw them again. Mm. It was probably the most godforsaken place I have ever seen. Confusion, pushing, people were yelling, shoving, dogs were barking, Nazis were yelling orders. No, I don't know how anybody could make any sense out of that place.
And one of the things they were shouting, right, one of the things they were shouting at you and your mom, what your mother was, that they asked your mother if you and your sister, if you were twins.
Yeah. Yeah, my mother didn't, we did not, no, they were, yeah, once he asked, first they were yelling for twins, but we did not volunteer any information. Then he noticed us, the Nazi who was running on the selection platform. When he noticed us, he demanded to know if we were twins. And my mother asked, is that good? And the Nazi nodded yes, and my mother said yes. And then another Nazi came, pulled my mother in one direction. Our pleading and crying fell on deaf ears. And all I remember is seeing my mother's arm stretched out in despair as she was pulled away. It happened so fast that I didn't even think about saying goodbye to her, and I never got to say do so. Because they just pulled her in one direction. We were pulled in the opposite direction. Our crying and pleading fell on deaf ears, and that was the last time I saw her. May 1944.
So that day was the last day you saw your mother, your other sisters, and your father.
My father, correct.
So you and your sister, you're both 10 years old. You're in this camp, these horrible human experimentations. What do you remember from that time?
Well, I need to talk a little bit more about that because the arrival, once we were taken away from my mother, we became part of a group. In our group, there were 13 sets of little twin girls between the ages of 2 and 16. And I am sure on that selection platform, there were twin boys. And twin boys and twin girls were kept separated according to age and sex. So boys were in one barrack, girls were in another barrack. We were processed. That meant that our hair was cut short. We were tattooed. They heated a lamp and they heated a needle, a long needle with a handle over the flame of a lamp. And then when the needle got hot, they dipped it into ink and they burned into my left arm. Dot by dot, the capital letter A-7063. Miriam became capital A-7064. It's important to note that Auschwitz was the only Nazi camp that tattooed its inmates. My husband, who is a survivor of 4 years of Buchenwald, which was another big camp, he does not have a tattoo. Once we were processed, we were taken to our barrack. The conditions in the barrack was filthy, crude. The barrack was divided in two by a brick bench. On each side of the brick bench was a walkway and then the three-story high bunk bed. We have not been able to sleep much on the cattle car because we were crammed up like sardines. So there was no room really to sleep. We were just leaning against one another. So we thought it would be nice to be able to stretch out and sleep, but I couldn't sleep. Human beings cannot function under such a after such a horrific day as we experienced. But as I was turning and tossing and turning in my bed, I noticed something big and dark. They looked like very, very big mice. I began screaming. Then a girl from the top bunk bed said, "Silly kid, these are not mice, they are rats." So now we couldn't even go back to our bunk bed because we were on the bottom and the rats were parading right by there. We went to the latrine, and as I entered the latrine, there on the filthy floor were the scattered corpses of three children. I have never seen anybody dead. And I realized, so it hit me immediately, that in this place, children are dying. So I made a silent pledge that I will do anything and everything within my power to make sure that Miriam and I shall not end up on that filthy latrine floor. Mm,
you just said that was that first day. Yeah, you decided that first day.
That first day. Because I arrived in Auschwitz as a very religious Jewish girl. My father was very religious. And the first night we were given the bread, I wouldn't even eat it, because it was not kosher. But once I saw the dead children, I did everything in my power to survive. So the experiment, I want to describe basically what we were. We were little girls between the ages of 2 and 16, huddled in our filthy bunk beds that were crawling with lice and rats. We were very badly infested with lice within a week. We were starved for food. We were starved for human kindness. And we were starved for the love of the mothers and fathers we once had. Yet we still had an unbelievable determination to live one more day, survive one more experiment. Because that's all we could concentrate on. We couldn't concentrate on anything more. I was used in two types of experiments. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, after our brownish, lukewarm, bitter, liquid cold coffee, that was breakfast, we would be taken to a room, about 50 sets of twins, naked, for 8 hours, standing and sitting. They would measure just about every part of my body, compare it to my twin sister, and then compare it to chart. And it was very detailed measurement. They could spend 3 hours on one arm. Those experiments were not dangerous, but they were very, very demeaning.
Humiliating.
And even in Auschwitz, I had some difficulty coping with that. So after a few days of those, once we would be taken to the observation lab, what I call the observation lab, my mind would go blank because I couldn't cope with it. The other days, on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, we would be taken to another lab that I call the blood lab. There they would tie both of my arms, take a lot of blood from my left arm, while at the same time giving me at least 5 injections into my right arm. Those were the deadly ones. After one of those injections, I became very ill with a very high fever. A fact I desperately tried to hide because the rumor in the camp was that anybody got sick and taken to the hospital and they never came back. What I can just assume that happened because we don't really have enough information. Mm-hmm. The data has disappeared. Books have not been written about it.
And you must have been worried, too, if you had been sick, what would have happened to your sister?
Well, I think that at that moment, yes, but I was definitely just the fact that I did not want to die. And it was why I knew I couldn't do a lot to defeat the Nazis, but that was my way of not letting the Nazis win. If I died, then they at least they would win as far as I'm concerned. So I arrived, I was taken to the hospital after they measured my fever. And at the time, I didn't understand how did they know I was sick. But of course, they knew because they injected me with something.
They were expecting
it. At the hospital, it looked just like another barrack. But the people who were there looked more dead than alive. They couldn't even walk. Most of them were just in their bunk bed screaming. Mengele came in next morning with 4 other doctors. And what amazed me even then, he never examined me. He looked at my fever chart and then he declared, kind of laughing sarcastically, he said to the other doctors, "Too bad she's so young. She has only 2 weeks to live." I knew he was right. I knew I was very ill. But again, I refused to die. So I made a second silent pledge that I will prove Mengele wrong, I will survive, and be reunited with my sister. For the following 2 weeks, I have only one clear memory, crawling on the barrack floor because I no longer could walk, and crawling to reach the other end of the barrack where somehow I discovered that there was a faucet with water because this barrack was not even allocated water. People were brought there to die. And as I was crawling, I would fade in and out of consciousness. And even in a semi-conscious state of mind, I kept telling myself, I must survive, I must survive. After 2 weeks, my fever broke, and I immediately felt a lot stronger. It took me another 3 weeks. So I was in the hospital for a total of 5 weeks. And I was released and reunited with the other twins and my twin sister. Now, Miriam looked very sick, and I could not understand what happened to her. What in Auschwitz was very, I tell people, it was very easy to die. To live was a full-time job. And what would happen to people who were discouraged and give up? And what I can only assume that Miriam might have given up that I would die. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But she was injected with something. Then I asked her, what have they done to you?
What did she say?
And she said, I cannot talk about it. I will not talk about it. We didn't talk about Auschwitz until 1985. By that time, I lived in Terre Haute, Indiana. The word Auschwitz never entered our conversation.
The two of you, never.
So I personally, I will tell you a strange thing. I picked up, we got back to Romania after the war to our village, to our home, and everything was gone. Everything was ransacked. I found 3 crumbled pictures on a bedroom floor. I picked them up, put them in my pocket, then I put them in an envelope. I never looked at those pictures until 1978.
Mm. Now, you said your sister...
I knew it was, mm-hmm. it was my family and us, but right. I was not able to face the past.
Oh, and now, I know that you said, you and your sister, remarkably, you and your sister survived, as we were just hearing. You all, together in 1984, your twin sister Miriam and you, in Terre Haute, you started an organization to try to find...
No, my sister didn't live in Terre Haute. My sister never lived in the United States.
Right, but...
Miriam lived in Israel.
Mm.
I started the organization. I began what happened was, I began lecturing in 1978 after the Holocaust show appeared, was aired by NBC. And people kept asking me about the details of the experiments. Well, I knew a little bit about myself, but I didn't know much more about anybody else. So I began reading books about Mengele, but there was nothing about the experiments except the fact that he did experiments on twins. So then I decided that there were all these children who were filmed by the Soviet Army. They were called liberation films. And there were a couple of hundreds or quite a lot of them, and I wondered where they all survived. What if I found them and we had a reunion and we would share our memories? But where do I find people I have not seen in so many years? So I began a very long campaign. There was no internet, no computer, none of that. And it took me about 5.5 years when I remember in December of 1983.
Eva, I'm going to stop you for a minute there because we have to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation about your search for these twins that you're doing as part of the work that you're doing with the Candles Holocaust Museum in Terre Haute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Eva Moses-Kaur. She's a Holocaust survivor. She lives in Terre Haute, Indiana now, where she has founded the Candles Holocaust Museum. We're talking to her about her story. She's been telling us about her story, she and her sister, twins, how they were able to survive Auschwitz. Eva, you were saying just before the break about how you're traveling around, you're sharing your stories. One part of your story that we haven't gotten to, and you shared this in the Chicago suburbs a couple months ago, you were speaking to students at Homewood Flossmoor High School.
You were talking about forgiveness, and you have a remarkable story of you actually meeting doctors who worked with you at Auschwitz. You were able to interact with one doctor 20 years ago. What made you decide to go and meet one of the Nazi doctors who experimented on you and held you captive?
The way things evolved, actually, it wasn't my idea. It was, I was lecturing about medical ethics, which I also do in addition to forgiveness. And that doctor asked me to bring along a Nazi doctor with me. And I said, where exactly do you think I could find one of those guys? They didn't advertise in the Yellow Pages. So
right.
That's funny, but I want you to think about it. And when I did think about it, I remembered the name of a doctor that appeared on a documentary that Miriam and I did a year earlier. And that is the way I contacted the filmmakers, and they gave me his telephone number. I didn't know what would happen. He refused to come to United States, to Boston, to lecture, but was willing to meet with me at his house. I was very scared about meeting a Nazi doctor.
Where did you go?
But he Excuse me?
Where did you go? Where was his house?
It was, he lived in Ravshaupten, about 2 hours from Munich. And we were going to film the interviews that I could take to Boston College. Well, he treated me with kindness, respect, and I was blown away by his respect that he was showing me. And the interview went very well. We finished it for my conference in Boston. And then out of the blues, I asked him if he knew anything by any chance about the operation of the gas chamber. And how interesting it was, he said that this was the nightmare that he lived with every single day of his life, that he was actually, not daily, but often stationed at the gas chamber, watching through a peephole how the gas chambers operated, and when everybody was dead, he would sign a death certificate. I have never heard about that part of the Holocaust or the gas chamber operation, so I immediately asked him to go with me to Auschwitz, because that was 1993, and 2 years later I was going to be at Auschwitz, actually a year and a half later. And he agreed with me.
So he agreed to come with you?
Yes. Now, I got back to Terre Haute, Indiana, so excited that I will have an original document, and if I ever run into a revisionist who say the Holocaust didn't happen, I could take that document and shove it in their face. But for some strange reason, I wanted to thank him, and I had no idea how to thank a Nazi doctor. And I knew it was a very unusual thing, that if I ask my friends or family, that they might convinced me not to do it, and I didn't want anybody to intervene in what I wanted to do. So it took me 10 months of brainstorming, and when I was cooking, cleaning, or driving the car, I kept asking myself, how can I thank this Nazi doctor? And after 10 months, a simple idea popped into my head. How about a letter of forgiveness from me to him? I knew right away that he would like it, but what I discovered for myself was life-changing. I discovered that I had one power left after all that happened, that I had the power to forgive. No one could give it to me, and no one could take it away, and I could use it in any way I wished. For somebody like me who survived the horrors of Auschwitz, to discover that I had any power over my life was an unbelievable thing, because all victims of all tragedies feel tremendous anger, pain. They feel hopeless. They feel helpless. They feel powerless. And I discovered I had power. So it took me another 4 months to write out my letter, and then I was concerned about my spelling. And I called my former English professor, who actually lives in Charleston, Illinois. And we met about three times. And the third time she said to me, "Now, Eva, that's very nice. You forgive Dr. Munch, but your problem is not with Dr. Munch. Your problem is with Dr. Mengele." I was not quite ready to do that yet, but she said to me, "It would be nice if you went home tonight and pretended I was talking to Mengele and telling him that I forgive him," because she said, "I want you to see how it would make you feel if you could do that." So that is what I did. And when I said to Mengele, I had actually a long list of nasty words I read to him. After that, I said, "In spite of all that, I forgive you." It was a very interesting feeling to realize that I, the little victim of almost 50 years, I even had power over Mengele. And there was nothing that Joseph Mengele could do to change that. Since I was not hurting anybody, I definitely could do it. And if I forgave Mengele, I forgave everybody. Now, what people...
How did I wonder, how did that change your outlook on life, that moment?
I have dealt with that question more often than you realize. First of all, to understand when somebody is hurt by life or destiny, like we were, or any other pain, something is broken inside one's heart, soul, and spirit. Once I could forgive, I felt whole inside. I was no longer broken. People say to me, "How can you forgive the Nazis?" And I usually answer it with a question. Do I deserve to be free from what they have done to me? And the answer is, of course, yes. Well, that's what I was doing. By forgiveness, I was restoring that broken spirit to make it whole again. And each person has to do it for himself or herself. Nobody can do it for me, and I cannot do it for anybody else.
Eva, I can't help but think of everything, the events of the past couple of months, as we've seen sales of Hitler's Mein Kampf, how much it's been selling in Germany over the past year. We've been seeing reports of white nationalist movements in the United States. We've seen incidents of hate crimes. Anecdotally, we've heard about hate crimes that have happened in the U.S. over the past couple of months. In fact, there's news out of Chicago this morning about that's being investigated as a hate crime. How do you approach all of this? How do you think about that now, about the world that we're living in right now?
First of all, I detest the fact that people who are, so to speak, on the left, or people who are, so to speak, on the right, get at each other and always bring up Hitler and the Holocaust. There is no comparison. My dear, there is absolutely zero comparison. Why did Hitler rise to power? Because the United States and the government of Roosevelt, whom I dearly admired, President Roosevelt, and the rest of the world appeased Adolf Hitler. Do you know that I have here at the museum a docent who arrived from Germany as a refugee Jew in 1939? His father was questioned repeatedly by the immigration services while on the streets of New Jersey, Nazis were marching with swastikas and Nazi flags. The fact is that everybody appeased Adolf Hitler, United States included, and it was Roosevelt who did it. They were more concerned about communism than Adolf Hitler. And if United States wouldn't have been attacked at Pearl Harbor, United States would not have entered World War II. And the world would look completely different. United States definitely saved the world from the terrorists called the Nazis. What happened in recent years? United States appeased ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and everybody else. So if we want to compare anything, the right wing and the left wing. The left wing ought to grow up. I lived in communist Romania. I didn't quite like it, and I don't think that we like what's going on in Cuba either. There has to be a balance between left and right. I agree on one thing, that all the Americans want people to have good jobs. They want to have good health care. They want people to respect one another. I think that name-calling and pointing fingers ought to stop. And if either President of the United States, like Obama was for 8 years, or anybody who will become President of the United States, I would intervene a couple of conferences a year on the two extreme groups, the left wing and the right group. We are all Americans. We all want the same thing for our families, for our children, for our future. I think we, instead of pointing fingers at one another, let's see what we have in common.
And is that something, I mean, in part of your museum, I wonder how much you think...
that's what we are trying to do. Mm-hmm. We are trying to teach people to respect one another. The finger pointing does not do anything good for anybody except the politicians.
And with your museum, so, right, with the work that you try...
We are trying to prevent genocide. We have even workshops for young people on human rights. As we are speaking right now here today, do you know that there are millions of people in Darfur that are still being killed? And the world is doing nothing. There are people, of course, who are being killed in Syria. There are people who are being killed in Iraq. And United States, there are Christians being killed by Muslims in Iraq and in the, many of these countries. There are Muslims killed. There are many Muslims killed in Syria and in other places.
So for you, Eva, for your work, I imagine you said your lesson that you want everyone to remember is to not forget, because you're saying this is happening now again and you want people to pay attention
to it. Well, I think the way not forgetting is not enough. That is, to me, it's just a slogan. I think how we remember it should be the question. Not to get even, but to prevent it. Forgiveness is the only way that people will heal themselves and still remember and stand up with good ideas to try to stop it. But we see it happening. Not by the time it gets as big as ISIS or Hitler got. Before that, we have to resolve misunderstandings, conflicts, when they are small.
Thank you for taking the time to join with us.
There is a way.
Eva, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We're speaking with Eva Moses Kaur. I should mention, each year the Candles Holocaust Museum organizes a trip for people to spend a week with her at Auschwitz for an educational tour. There's still a couple spots left, I know. We're going to send out the information, a link for that, for people who want to have more information about that. Eva, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and share your story.
Thank you for being interested, and I will invite people. I'm trying to teach the world to heal through forgiveness.
Thank you, Eva.
We're out of time for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to send us an email, if you want to follow us on social media, all of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.